Greetings, my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. I'm Paula. Politics matters. Many Republicans believe government exists entirely to protect business and enrich the wealthy. Our guest, Thomas Frank, is a former Young Republican and author of The Wrecking Crew, How Republicans Rule. In it, Mr. Frank contrasts the everyday cultural conservatives he described in his book, What's the Matter with Kansas, with Bush-Cheney-McCain Republicans. By carefully documenting their free market fundamentalism and right-wing extremism, Mr. Frank exposes how Republicans have deliberately undermined the U.S. government and its agencies in stark defiance of federal laws and the U.S. Constitution. It's the Republican way, Mr. Frank says, and they want to make it permanent. How long does Mr. Frank think these attacks on democracy can last? That depends.
It's not sustainable because what they're interested in, of course, is immediate gain. Look, this is the nature of capitalism. It always prioritizes immediate gain over long term. And so they wreck down the regulatory state because the regulatory state, OSHA bugs them, labor unions bug them. All these things are cutting down on their profit margin. They want them gone. They get them gone. And then look what happens. They cannibalize themselves. I mean, they revert instantly to 19th century form, as we're seeing before our very eyes. But there's any number of ways that they've used to make their vision of the state permanent. And one of them is the outsourcing and privatizing of all this federal work. How are you going to get that back? And another one is deficits. They build up these monster deficits, and you're stuck with it. You're stuck with it for 20 or 30 years.
Thomas Frank is a political observer, historian, and researcher. Before his book, The Wrecking Crew, Mr. Frank was widely known for his keen observations in What's the Matter with Kansas and One Market Under God. He's received the Lannan Award, was founding editor of The Baffler, a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, and he's a regular columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Bill Russell and I share Mr. Frank's sense of urgency in understanding how profoundly Republicans have defied the American dream, and we lost no time getting started in this conversation.
Thomas Frank, I remember being in college and being very excited that I could take a government course because I would then know what the rules were. The one question looking back I wish that I had asked in my government classes is, what do you do when they cheat? Isn't that the question that we have failed to ask for about 40 years?
That's a really good way of putting it.
Isn't that the essential missing?
What about when they don't play by the rules?
Precisely.
What do you do?
Precisely.
Do you cry for the playground monitor?
Well, in America, we think of this as, we really honor fair play. Everybody's going to do right. We're all honorable. After all, we're Americans. But it ain't true.
No,
what do you do when they cheat?
Well, so far what you do is you lose when the other side cheats. Their cheating is rewarded, and they win. You want me to give you an example from the book is what I'm betting.
I don't care if it's from the book or not. If you'd like to, the book is fine.
Or from your next book.
Whether you call it cheating or whether you call it just playing by their own rules or playing in an extraordinarily hardball sort of manner.
I'll give you, I'll up the ante. What if they're vandals?
Okay. See, you're better at this than me. I mean, this is Paula. You should explain this book.
I could, but I'd rather you did since you wrote it.
You have more credibility.
All right. What the book is about conservatism as you see it in Washington D.C., which is a very different creature than what you see, say, in a place like Kansas or in one of your red states or your culture war battles or anything like that. And yes, vandalism is one way of describing what conservatives in Washington have done. Not playing by the rules is another way. But basically what you're talking about is people that have managed to take over the government and then say, let's take, they take a department, say the Department of Labor. Okay, Congress set up the Department of Labor 80 years ago to, look after the worker in this country to mind the workplaces.
Regular people.
People.
We the people?
Yeah.
Those people?
When we go to work, this department is supposed to be have us on their mind. Well, what if you get people in government who don't agree with that mission and who think, Congress was, that's an annoying thing. And you remember when President Reagan ran in 1980, it was like a the businessman's crusade against OSHA. Remember, OSHA is a part of the Department of Labor. That's why I bring it up.
I remember it, but it's hard to remember because this is the Occupational Safety Hazards Administration.
Oh, I know. That's the problem with all of these things.
Who knew?
With all of these things is that you're talking about things that are, at the same time, incredibly important, you know, to everything around us, as we're finding out right now as we watch the financial world come crashing down around our ears, incredibly important to the very basis of the way we live. And at the same time, you can't be bothered to remember the name. You know, even I can't, you know.
Yeah.
What was the scandal last week? The MMS, Mining and Minerals, I don't even know, part of the Department of the Interior. We'll come to that later, though. But let's say you get these guys in power who don't believe in the mission. They don't believe in these agencies that you've set up.
They don't believe in government.
Yeah. Some parts of government they do. They like the police force. They like the army.
This is called a night watchman state.
Yeah. They like the Federal Reserve for reasons that were all too apparent right now.
that is to say, it'll bail them out when they fail.
That's right. They did not like the Federal Reserve before, say, 1978. But because it used to be run by Keynesians. You know, it used to be run by liberals. I mean, it was set up by Wilson and then reinvigorated by Roosevelt as a very liberal enterprise.
Because the system had come unstuck.
Yeah, the system had,
off the tracks,
in a word, failed. And we needed we needed someone minding the financial system and, you know, keeping the guardrails up and, you know, moderating the speed, speeding it up, slowing it down, doing all the things that had to be done, hence a Federal Reserve. That's why you have it. But anyhow, so conservatives don't disagree with every aspect of government. You know, they like prisons, you know.
Especially when you've privatized them and they're profitable.
Oh, yeah. But the liberal state is what I'm talking about. And that's when they talk about how much they hate government, that's what they're referring to, is the liberal state, things, essentially government since Franklin Roosevelt. So
Let's come back in just a moment with Thomas Frank and talk about what that means, because we need to redefine a number of things in the United States, including the word liberal, which has lost the original
meaning. Well, we need to, I think, reclaim the language, don't
Indeed.
We? Is that part of this?
We'll do that when we come back with Thomas Frank. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell, I'm Paula. Thomas Frank, be with us when we return. Welcome back. I am Paula Gordon, Bill Russell. We're delighted to be with Thomas Frank. A lot of people would know your name and associate it with a very widely read book called What's the Matter with Kansas?
I might also mention, even more people know me as the Big Hurt. I used to hit home runs for the Chicago White Sox.
Oh, well, that would do it, wouldn't it? I'm going to change the subject from baseball for just a moment.
Actually, I want to stay with that Big Hurt thing. How has the reception been for this book in places like Kansas and McLean, Virginia?
I wanted to say there's a book that he has written since What's the Matter with Kansas called The Wrecking Crew.
That's what we're talking about, The Wrecking Crew.
Yeah.
I was in Kansas the other day, there's a large audience, and they seemed very appreciative.
Forgive me, I'm going to use this word once, resonate with the message?
Absolutely, of course. Well, listen, let me tell you, The Wrecking Crew is about conservative misrule, about, you know, these agencies thrown into reverse, these incompetent people put in charge, this sort of massive wave of corruption and scandal, you know, the lobbying, all that stuff. I have yet to find anybody. I've been on this book tour. Did I tell you 6 weeks I've been on this book tour? I have yet to have anybody stand up for that system and say, no, that system rocks, that system delivers, that system is, you know, that's great stuff. You've got it all wrong. Frank, you know what they say instead? Those people are liberals. What you're talking about? Yeah, this George W. Bush, liberal. Ronald Reagan, you know, if he did what you say he did, liberal. Yes.
No.
Yes. This happened to me just the other day. I was in a radio debate. I don't even remember what city I was in. I believe it was in Chicago. And there was you have a lot of guys who really believe in conservative principles, and they see what the Bush administration is doing, and it's cognitive dissonance. This was their man. 4 years ago, they worshipped him. They bought little bronze statuettes of him to put on their, you know, on their desk. And look what he's done. And they're only response is to say, he is liberal, he is liberal, he is not me, he is the other. Well,
but that's part of the game that they're playing.
Yeah, it is. I mean, this goes opportunism.
Well, we've got, you know, we're sitting in the middle of a political campaign where you've got the candidate of the Republican Party running against his party.
Yeah.
And the party applauding him for running against the party as if somehow or other Republicans, I mean, they're new zombies.
You know, there was?
New zombies.
Yeah, somebody took over their minds. No, not the old zombies. We're the new ones.
Did you see
Mitt Romney's speech at the Republican convention 2 weeks ago? Romney said, Washington, D.C. isn't conservative. It is liberal. And he said, and it's been liberal for 30 years.
I have to ask you a question right here, because some of what is at the heart of classic propaganda, and you go to the book, you look under P, propaganda, is you take words and you twist them, and you make them something else.
Well, this is Orwell.
You say it louder and louder and louder and louder. I'm saying Alice in Wonderland was a wimp. Aren't you telling me that this is all very cynical manipulation of a very eager-to-be-fooled audience?
Oh, yeah. Well, cynicism is the name of the game here. I mean, this book could have been called Adventures in Cynicism or an Economy of Cynicism. I mean, you've got people that, running against their own party is just the start of it. These are people who have ruled Washington, D.C. for 30 years. And, you know, and there's a biography of Bush that came out a few years ago, and they called him the rebel in chief. He's supposed to be a rebel against the Washington, D.C. order. The dude is the president. And his party controlled Congress at the time, and they had for many years. And before him, there was his dad. And before him, there was Ronald Reagan.
His surrogate dad.
Yeah. And to try to understand them as rebels against the system, which they have themselves built.
Which is the same, that McCain is doing. He's saying, well,
now
I'm a maverick.
He has slightly better claim.
Well,
to that.
91%. He's got a 9% better claim.
Yes, he does. There are a few real things that he did that Bush would never have done. But, I mean, let's give him credit for that later on. But that's just the beginning. That kind of cynicism is just the beginning. You've got to remember, these people come into office with this deep hatred of the liberal state and these extraordinarily cynical views of the liberal state, where they, in their mind, government is not a legitimate institution. The market, man, that is legitimate. That's natural. That's civil society. That is the real world. Government is this imposition.
A free market. any market.
By the way, we're talking about cynicism. I mean, one of the things that they do is toss concepts and constituencies overboard when it becomes convenient. You know, there is no loyalty to anything except for business. And the concept of the free market has always been sort of the greatest fig leaf of them all for, you know, the needs of business, the needs of the upper class in America. So that's just the free market in action. That's just globalization is what did that to you, buddy. You know, come on. And then of course when they need to be bailed out, then it's like, you know, forget the free market. Even that goes, you know.
There's nothing free about the free market.
We socialize the debts, we socialize the losses, and we privatize the profits. I mean, this is.
That's right.
That again.
It's not an exaggeration. It's not a real thing. You can find it anywhere.
It's still good.
That's in What's the Matter with Kansas. That's a well-known. I mean, I quote it from the Wall Street Journal back then. You know,
and we're doing it. We're right smack in the middle of another one of those exercises.
Yep.
And history. You're a historian.
I mean, do you think they're going to make the former CEO of Merrill Lynch give back his $100 million? Severance package or whatever.
I want to go back. This notion of a free market is simply incorrect. The market has never been free.
It's a utopian scheme. It can never happen.
And it wouldn't work anyway.
Yeah.
And the closer we get, the more obvious that is. But we're not even close because they're it's not a free market. It is a manipulated market. It's essentially crony capitalism, which is not the same as a free market.
The closer you get to a free market, the worse. Ask the people in Saipan. You know,
exactly.
The closer you get to where management has all the power, the workers have none. I mean, because a union is also supposed to be a violation of the free market. So if the workers get together and organize, oh, the free market's gone, got to bust that up. So the closer you get to a free market is the closer you get to sort of pure, 19th century misery.
Yes.
Which I describe in the book, there's been some experiments in this, even on American soil. And I mentioned Saipan, this island in the Western Pacific where they...
Which is our territory. It is part of the United States of America.
But when they signed up to be part of the U.S., they got to control their own immigration law and their own minimum wage and a couple other things. And they take this great deal that they got from us, but it's part of the U.S., so there's no tariff duties on anything they manufacture there. And they show it around to various manufacturers in the world, and next thing you know, I mean, they've got this sweatshop gulag there just built overnight. You know, they import workers. They work for very low wages. The stuff gets sent to America. It's made in the USA. When the workers get out of line or complain or do anything wrong, boom, back to their home country. And of course, the workers have borrowed money to come there, so they don't dare, step out of line. And this has become the entire economy on the island. It started with the garment factories, but now it's like, the hotels, the resorts, even the newspapers run on workers brought in from other countries. And people have domestic servants, even, welfare recipients on Saipan have servants in their house because they can pay them, I think it's less than $1 an hour. By the way, they could. This is all, their lobbyist was a fellow named Jack Abramoff.
Yes.
And job was to keep the federal government from coming in and applying our horrible liberal rules to them. And now that he's out of the picture, we did it.
Before we go to Jack the Ripper, can we call him Jack the Ripper? It just occurred to me. Saucy Jack. You say that the management is in charge on Saipan, and it's important. The piece that you didn't quite add that I would like you to add and continue to explore is that they also control the government.
Yeah.
So it isn't just the guys who run the businesses. They also the business community runs the government.
That's right.
And the government. So
by definition, because it's ethnically defined, the citizens are the citizens there are the indigenous islanders.
And these workers have no chance to become citizens.
No, they can't become citizens. They can't vote. Can't serve on juries.
Don't you call that at least indentured servitude, if not slavery?
It is. I think by definition, it is debt bondage, which is a mm-hmm. form of indentured servitude. So yeah, that's what it is. and it's pretty rugged.
I had thought until I read your book that Burma was rapidly becoming the model for what these people have in mind.
Burma.
Myanmar.
Look at the way the government operates there. It has a lot of the same similarities. You essentially have a plutocracy that does what it bloody well pleases. Has essentially alienated itself from the rest of the world, so it doesn't. There's not much interference, and in a way that sort of describes what these folks want to do. But Saipan was it's closer to home.
Saipan's up there.
Well, it's closer
Saipan's
to home.
It's
part of the U.S.
And it's like Dubai or something like that. And
what Iraq was supposed to be.
The free market paradise.
Right.
Yeah.
Is it possible that we could ask these people to move there?
You mean the people who created it, who have now are overseeing our demise?
I want to go back. This it's easy to mock this because it's just so patently absurd.
Yeah.
If we weren't smack in the middle of it, you said you were talking earlier about the liberal state, and liberal has been so thoroughly abused in the language that I think most people are clueless about what you mean when you say a liberal state.
And having had a real good time in this segment, let's start there again when we come back in a moment.
That's right.
You'll be serious, aren't you?
Thomas Frank will address liberal and the liberal state when in a moment we come back. Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon, we trust you'll be with us. Welcome back. This is the Paula Gordon Show. I'm Paula, Bill Russell. Thomas Frank, not to be confused with Frank Thomas, the baseball player you just told me. liberal state.
Yeah.
That used to have a meaning that was liberal arts.
It was broadly popular, too. I mean, it was
something
that you wanted to be. Yeah. I'm on a one-man crusade to rescue the word liberal.
So we'll be on a three-man crusade, what do you say? So what does it mean that has been so trashed, much less forgotten?
Well, I mean, liberalism is certainly, in the classical definition, is just this belief in maximizing human freedom. And then it got updated in the 1930s. There's a famous definition from the 30s that I like of liberalism, where it's freedom plus groceries.
Whoa!
Yeah.
Who did that?
Well, it was a congressman from Texas.
Fabulous. You mean something good did come out of Texas?
There used to be a lot of liberals from Texas. It's hard to believe. Like Lyndon Johnson,
Used to be a lot of liberals from Kansas, but that's another subject.
And from Nebraska. They had a Republican senator called George Norris, and his nickname was the Fighting Liberal.
Well, Wisconsin, the home of Joseph McCarthy, misplaced, displaced.
La Follette, right?
One of the great progressives of all time.
Yeah.
Fighting Bob.
Yeah.
Not just any old senator. Well, he displaced Junior.
Yeah.
Little Bob, I think they call him. But Fighting Bob La Follette, Norris, these folks in the Midwest, which was a hotbed of taking care of each other.
That's right. A hotbed of kindness, a hotbed of niceness.
Holy cow.
How primitive.
I know, it's funny, isn't it?
It's not just historians, though, to whom this is important. This is important to all of us because we've forgotten, along with the idea of liberal being...
Freedom plus groceries.
Fabulous. And what then is the liberal state?
The liberal state is where it's the traditional 19th century capitalist state, but with all the safeguards thrown in. Okay, with Keynesian economics, with the regulated financial markets, with a safe workplace, with a labor union, so that people have some voice at the place that they work. It is just it's democracy applied to economics.
I wondered if that word would come into this.
What?
Democracy, that much abused word. Democracy in the economic system.
The liberal state is economic democracy. So it's democracy not only in politics, but also in the world of economics. And that's what has been undone. That's what's been under such brutal attack for 30 years.
And with that goes an attack on social democracy.
Yeah. Yeah, and the word liberal now, I mean, means snob. Or something. God, where was I the other day? And I heard someone called someone a liberal as like an imprecation, like they, just yelling at somebody on the street. You goddamn liberal!
No.
Yeah.
Just because it was in, just because they didn't like them.
Yeah. Or they, I mean, yeah. And
it was probably Saturday night in Iowa City.
No.
I don't remember where it was, but it was really shocking to me. Yeah. And I was just walking along. It might have been in Iowa City. I don't know. Yeah, and it was a funny thing. There's no physical marks to identify the person as a liberal, but it was just an insult, right? And now it means snob. It means this sort of intellectual, but intellectual in the hated sense, not in the sense like that we respect learning or something like that. But somebody that's read a lot of books and wants to interfere in every aspect of your life. It means a kind of upper class tyrant, and it's been given this sort of class definition.
And coming from the people who are the ruling, as it were, class.
Oh, Paula.
I know.
Where to begin?
Yes.
Look.
Yes.
Yes, what you're saying is true.
But isn't that part of the dilemma?
Yeah.
Where to begin?
That is what you're saying is true, that this definition has been applied to them very successfully by people who represent the actual ruling class in this country, i.e., big business, the very wealthy, high net worth individuals, the great fortunes, that sort of thing. They're the ones that funded and led the attack on liberalism ever since the 1930s, and it's only come into flower since the 1970s.
And but the now funded very part widespread. Was really, really important, because this was in a very considered, conscious act on the part of those who were, as you say, business, the high net worth individuals, the big fortunes.
They hated Roosevelt.
Roosevelt, that's 70 years ago.
But that's when they started counterattacking. And they got nowhere for a very long time. And it wasn't until the 60s and 70s.
Now, why would that be that they got nowhere? There's a line in this book I read by Thomas Frank called The Wrecking Crew that says, the people actually liked the liberal state.
They still do. If you do polls all the time, do people like Social Security? Hell yeah. And then ask them, well, do you like the even better? How about the idea of having a secure retirement? People really like that. How about the idea of having pure food? How about the idea of having food that doesn't poison you and have making sure that that's the case?
Healthcare.
Oh, people dig that.
How do we feel about health care?
The idea that if a member of your family gets sick that you're going to go bankrupt, turns out that's a really unpopular situation. People don't like that.
And that all is embedded in the idea of the liberal state.
Mm-hmm. That's liberalism.
I want to go back to Paula's original question, which is what happens when they cheat? And this is, I've been thinking about it a long time because we've had a long time to think about it, more than 8 years, 40 years, plus or minus, depending on where you start. And there, it seems there are two problems with the cheaters. One, a lot of their cheating is illegal. And then the question is, one, does one enforce? can the laws be enforced, and will the laws be enforced, which is one issue. The other, and in some ways it's sort of an existential challenge, is that this approach is not sustainable.
You mean the current cheating approach?
Well, you, at some point you run out of somebody to steal from.
Yeah. As we're finding out right now.
Exactly. And we've sort of cleaned out this house, we're now borrowing from the Chinese, various Middle Eastern countries, Russia.
We're all going to be working for the Qatari Sovereign Wealth Fund.
If we're lucky.
Yeah.
That's
capitalism in action.
That's not funny.
You know? I'm sorry. Look, Paula, you wonder why I laugh at all this stuff. And there is no way to write a book like this and without taking the kind of ironic attitude that I have. Otherwise, you would go mad. It's too depressing. It's too awful. And it's also too systematic. I mean, one of the things that I couldn't believe when I was writing this is like, why hasn't someone written this book yet? Why do I have this field all to myself? It's not funny. What the hell is going on?
Yeah.
One of the real insights in this book that I went back and just sort of savored is something called the Jamba Declaration.
Yeah. Unbelievable. I had no idea about this.
I think in some ways that sort of is almost a paradigm for all of what's gone on in the last, 30 years. 40 years is a nice round number. Tell me about the Jamba Declaration.
Okay, well, there's a lot of backstory to it. This is
truncated.
I'll give you a 1.5 minute backstory and then get to Jamba.
Okay. Look, when I wrote the book, I settled on several different narrative strategies that I would take. I would describe Washington physically. I would describe the systems of government and how they've been wrecked. And I would describe the career of Jack Abramoff, who seemed to me to be the ideal man of conservative Washington, D.C., really the ideal figure.
And had been a long time. Well,
yes.
And you're doing this not because he is a bad apple.
No, he's representative. Jack Abramoff was a great idealist. He was the protege of leaders of the movement. He was
the movement for a while.
Yeah, he was the leader. And he would surface here and there in all these different places that you would never expect. He was the head of the College Republicans. He ran a think tank. He had a role in Iran-Contra. And then one of the stranger things that he did is he was running I don't know what you would call it, a grassroots group in D.C. And he somehow, he had developed this fondness. He'd been doing this in the College Republicans for right-wing guerrilla movements around the world. He and his friends, and this was a big deal, this is the Reagan years. Remember, we had the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, we had the Contras in Nicaragua, but there were other ones. There was a right-wing group fighting in Mozambique, and there's a right-wing group fighting in Angola. Some of these guys were incredibly bad, okay? They were what we would call now terrorists. We were funding them. These are all people on our side.
Right. Some of them were running armies, though. I mean, this is right. goes yeah. beyond just, I mean, it was terrorism. It was terrorism by organized armies.
Oh, of course. Right. And what I mean is like planting landmines all over Angola and that sort of thing.
Slaughtering
civilians.
Rape, mutilation, the full litany. Not nice people.
No.
Gets us to Jamba?
It does, as a matter of fact. Okay, so there was this, on the right, there was this cult of what they called the Freedom Fighter, okay, meaning all these different right-wing guerrilla groups. And the idea occurred to them that what they really needed to do was get all these guys together in one place and have a kind of right-wing Woodstock. And it was their grand scheme, their sort of cultural pattern that they were always after was to do what the left had done in the 60s, but everything in reverse. So like they would have big protests where they'd all be wearing ties, you know?
That's important.
Symbolically, it was, and it was a really good fundraising strategy as well. You know, take the tactics of the left, but use them on the right. And they really took this, they went much farther than the left and were much, much more successful than the left, as you notice once you, Jack Abramoff became one of the most successful lobbyists in Washington history. But anyhow, so they decided they'd have this big get-together of all these right-wing guerrilla groups in territory liberated by force of arms from a Soviet client state in Angola. And they were going to do it at the guy that, of all the freedom fighters, the one they loved most was this fellow called Jonas Savimbi in Angola. And he was a very charismatic guy. He always walked around with a big pistol on his hip and this sort of thing. And they all got together and they got some people from Afghanistan, some Contras, some, I think, people from Laos or something like that, and brought them all to Savimbi's hideout.
A few Nazis, didn't they?
Yeah, you said so.
They came in later. That was a different meeting.
Just want to be sure.
That was meeting number two. That was a, and then they went to...
That was Altamont, right?
You know, if I left that joke in, I believe I removed that joke to compare. This was the Altamont of the.
You didn't leave it in, but
this
was
the first one was the Woodstock. The second one was the Altamont. But I believe I cut. How did you guess? I cut that out of the book.
So it's screamingly obvious. Besides, I was at Altamont.
Oh no!
Okay, we're going to come back with that moment when we return. Be with us. Welcome back. This is the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. It is a great pleasure to be with Thomas Frank, Bill Russell, I, Paula. This at the leading edge thing really matters to me. This is where we are and where we are going forward. And it really matters that people like you have taken the trouble to go back and find this stuff that just sounds crazy, but is so important to where we are now.
The research in this book was... It involved a lot of research on apartheid South Africa. Jack Abramoff had a lot going on with apartheid South Africa. A lot of research on...
He was on the apartheid side.
Yeah.
This was the old...
I'm sorry, did I not make that clear?
No, well, I just want to make sure nobody is missing that.
But he was also on the payroll.
Yeah, but indirectly. He always denied any knowledge of this.
Right.
But the...
In my
own opinion is impossible, or highly implausible, let's put it that way. These guys would never say, they weren't racists, and they wouldn't say, you know, I love apartheid, it's a great system. They'd say, you know, this government is a staunch ally against communism, and we have to support them with everything we got, and so they would go over there. But Savimbi, who I mentioned earlier, was apartheid's, that's who funded and armed him. He was their proxy in the war against the government of Angola, which was a Soviet client regime. I mean, so that's what happened. Then they did have a second
get together,
the Altamont to Jamba's Woodstock. By the way, the Jamba Declaration. This was something that they, I believe, Grover Norquist wrote. He's sort of always surfaces here and there in the Abramoff story. They were great friends, and I believe Grover wrote it.
He's sort of the intellectual center of this movement,
and he's a very intelligent man. And I mean, I want to talk about him later because he's in some ways. Very brilliant, first of all, and second of all, there is no equivalent to him on the left. There is nobody out there figuring out the kind of things that Grover figures out for the right.
But he's a bomb thrower as
sure.
well. I mean, he's an anarchist, essentially.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, he's one of the ones that would say things like, you know, I'm not against the government. I like, you know, we need jails and we need police, and it's
important to say, since we're doing words, that is classic libertarianism.
Mm-hmm. All of these guys that I'm talking about are by the way, libertarianism tends to get by as a kind of idealistic doctrine. It gets off the hook. People let it slide. There's a lot of libertarians in Washington, D.C. I would guess almost all of them paid to be libertarians there in Washington, D.C. Libertarianism is really the sort of fig leaf ideology of big money because it's constantly pushing for, you know, tax cuts, deregulation, the whole thing. And nothing is ever pure enough for libertarians. You know, you never actually get to the free market. And so their response is always, well, the reason you have any kind of market failure is because there was still government. Until you do away with government finally and forever, you're going to continue to have market failure. So, you know, so I haven't been proven wrong. We libertarians are never proven wrong when, you know, our free market experiment collapses. It's because there's still a little bit of government that's contaminating the experiment.
The problem is anarchy intrudes, but before you get to that pure point.
But we're still back at Jamba, aren't we?
Speaking of anarchy, go ahead. I want the Declaration.
I don't even remember what it is. I have it back in my files.
Not memorable?
But it looks like it was written by a teenager or somebody in high school. You know, it's just a mess.
You say it conflates the Declaration of Independence and the Gettysburg Address.
It's got lines from both of them all jumbled up, and it's just a...
I'll bet they're not attributed either.
Of course. They're so familiar, you know. But... It was the right hailed it at the time as this great, you know, statement. It was instantly forgotten. The whole thing was a giant disaster.
And a lot of people made money in the process.
In the process of building the right.
All of this stuff. Yeah.
I don't know about Jamba. Jamba was just a big botch.
That's a goof.
But all the way along, Savimbi did okay.
Yes.
Until the day he died, went down in a hail of bullets. But it's
important to say, as all these are happening, lots of profit is being spun off. I mean, you talk about the geography of Washington. It isn't by accident, say you, with great data to uphold the assertion. Washington, D.C. has been transformed into one of the richest places in the world.
It's the richest city in America. It's tied with the New York metro area and the Silicon Valley metro area, but the Washington Post is forever claiming it's the richest. And this came from somewhere.
It wasn't a backroom tinkerer who invented something.
The standard explanation is it's those damn liberals. You know, you got all those bureaucrats there in D.C. and they're overpaid. And that's get this, Paula. That's actually wrong.
Whoa!
Do you believe in the Enlightenment? Do you think evidence matters?
Well, look, I'm a writer. It matters to me. I mean, I don't know about the public. You know, it matters to me.
So evidence should be. I mean, your argument is that we should look at the evidence rather than the assertions that the language has been abused sufficiently.
That we should look at the evidence rather than the words.
Imagine that.
I'm afraid that is what I believe. Yes.
Well, I'm
one of these crazy arugula eating liberals. I'll go further than that. I actually grew arugula in a garden in Hyde Park, Chicago, in Barack Obama's legislative district.
I knew it was Hyde Park.
That goes back to the question you raised, which is, why hasn't somebody else told these stories? Washington is one of the most covered cities by the media. The media is all over it. They've got hundreds of thousands. Last I looked, 4,000 or 5,000 people accredited to the White House.
Oh, I know.
Who sit around and take dictation from
whoever. And you go to the conventions, the reporters outnumber the people at the conventions three to one. So why would nobody write about this?
And the answer
is... Are you just screamingly out of phase? Are you making this stuff up?
There is that. Well, I'm not now. Come on.
I have to ask.
You can read the footnotes. It's all there.
Well, and it is not always the case that reading the footnotes, and it is the case in The Wrecking Crew, and I am here to give evidence that reading the footnotes is as interesting as reading the book.
I have a strategy with the notes, and that's there's a lot of digressions that I can't make in the main narrative, and so they get pushed to the notes. So I have a lot of
data in there,
and it's really important.
Sorry about that. I mean, I know that it throws off your.
Well, I think it's really important to say the United States started as an Enlightenment experiment. The United States of America came out of an era.
Ironic, isn't it?
Well, it's painful to me that it came out of an era, was created by people who did believe in evidence, who did believe that we should take care of each other.
Respected learning. I went to Thomas Jefferson's University. Why has nobody else done this research? Right. I asked myself that all the time. When the Abramoff scandal broke, I thought, you know, that I was a college Republican. Did I tell you guys that?
No. Nope.
In the early 80s, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought,
but you sort of have that look.
I do, don't I?
College
you
Republican. Scary, ain't it?
Oh, I didn't last long.
Well, but it's very interesting progression, and you go through that in What's the Matter with Kansas. And you do disclose that you had been caught up in the same magic.
Reagan. Yeah. The reason I'm able to write about this stuff is that I believed it once. I mean, it was a long time ago, but I really, really believed it once.
And it started with that emotion toward that man.
No, it started. The thing was, it was the environment that I grew up in, and that whole the war against regulation. And you know, every adult that I knew was a businessman, large or small businessman, and that crusade against regulation in the 1970s. It just seems so obviously true. It's like, how can a bureaucrat come and tell you, you know, what to do in your own workplace? That's crazy. It's obviously tyranny. And then along comes Ronald Reagan saying this, and I would read it in Reader's Digest and in vital speeches of the day and that sort of thing. And I thought he was so absolutely right and so obviously correct. And, you know, I fell for it. But I was 15, you know. When you're 15, you fall for that kind of Reader's Digest view of the world, that Boy Scout view of the world. Turns out these guys aren't Boy Scouts, though.
Well, the Washington Press Corps is also not 15 years old,
at least
chronologically.
But why did they miss it? Why did they miss all this stuff? Well, okay, this is what I was getting at when I mentioned I was a college Republican. That name Abramoff, it was familiar to me. And I was like, you know, where have I heard that name? And so when he, you know, he was in the media, and the scandal was unwinding, and it was incredible. I mean, you remember all the weird angles to it, all the money that he ripped off, all the emails that came out, all the people that he had connections with who were turning their backs on him, you know, denying that they'd ever met him and this kind of thing. And so I did what everyone does, which is I did the LexisNexis search, and I found every article that had ever mentioned his name. And I sat down one afternoon and printed out the 150 pages and read it. And it starts out, oh, he was chairman of the College Republicans back when I was in the College Republicans. What do you know about that? Then he ran this group that did the stuff with Savimbi, the Jamba thing. Then he ran this think tank in Washington, D.C. And then you find, then he became a Hollywood film director. But this think tank that he was running in D.C., then is revealed 10 years later to have been a front group for the apartheid regime, and not just for the apartheid regime, for their military intelligence. And this came out in the Truth and Reconciliation hearings in South Africa. Then the guy becomes a lobbyist for Saipan.
Doesn't that border on treason?
Well, that's not up to me. I'm not a lawyer.
No, but I'm just curious. That to me is just on the ragged edge. Working for a foreign secret service would seem to be
mighty peculiar.
Well, peculiar, but also again, the question of legality in all of this. I don't want to distract us by that, but it just
okay.
Seems,
let's talk about that because anyhow. So I read the skeleton version of his life with the LexisNexis search, and then I was like, you know, I'm going to start looking into this. I call the College Republicans. No, you can't come look at our archives. So I go over to the Library of Congress. Turns out his think tank, International Freedom Foundation, had a magazine, Jack Abramoff Publisher. So I read every issue of it. I photocopied the whole thing. They had a newsletter. I found somebody in New York that had the newsletter. I found somebody that had all their direct mail. They did a lot of direct mail. I found all the College Republicans, somebody else that had all their direct mail. The thing is that to do this stuff requires library research. You can't do it online. And to get at the College Republicans, I had to not just go to the library. I had to make friends with former leaders of the College Republicans, and there are a lot of disgruntled College Republicans who are very happy to tell me about it. And they had been great admirers of Jack. He was a leader of men. He was a great CEO, they would say, and they couldn't understand how this man had become the sort of horrible figure that he did. And anyhow, we'll get back to the South Africa thing, but I just want to say the moral of the Jack Abramoff story, and the reason that it fascinates me is because what it shows is that you can be an idealist and a corruptionist at the same time in conservative D.C. You can believe in these principles of the free market and be bribing congressmen at the same time.
Well, that is a market.
Yeah, exactly.
You got it.
That's the book.
That, right. Yeah, the Congress as market. We're going to be back in a moment with a good deal more to be said with Thomas Frank. Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon, be with us when we return. We are delighted to be with Thomas Frank. Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon. I found myself and I had to sort of read The Wrecking Crew in pieces because it is overwhelming. And there is this.
In a good way.
In a fabulous way. Because
it's also very depressing. And I'm sorry for saying this, but it was a challenge because there's so much in there that we've known, we've watched. You connect it in ways that I'd never seen it connected before. And in some ways, it's even more trivial than I thought.
But also the know the truth and the truth will set you free.
Or the truth will make you mad. Or the truth will the truth will go buy you a big bottle of scotch.
To get through it.
Yeah.
And then on the other side, you can, it really is the truth will set you free. When you know this stuff, when it is no longer just so big and so overwhelming that it shuts you down, which I think I've been maintaining for a decade, that America has been in the throes of a deep clinical depression. We just didn't know what to do. We were overwhelmed by all this stuff, and it was getting worse and worse and worse. But I'm helpless. And helplessness is one of those markers for depression. Well, the way you get unhelpless, the way you start back up that very high mountain where I'm going to have to climb to put it all back together again, is to know what in the world was going on in this crazy place.
Yeah,
I wrote myself one note. I wrote myself many notes on the other pages, but on the back of the book, I have my own back leaf. It is Market Uberalis.
My God, Paula, show that to the camera.
No, Market Uberalis. And it seemed to me, I grew up in a very religious family, and I once asked, what's the difference between the Old Testament and the New Testament? And it's, you know, this is a little kid answer. Well, the Old Testament tells you what not to do, and the New Testament tells you what to do.
Yeah.
And I said, well, what's this first one about, I'm the only God and you shouldn't worship any other? Oh, okay, that's the first commandment. Well, when you, and the second, you know, the New Testament is do right, love each other. But when you have violated that first commandment, which is 4,000 years old and represents at least Western civilization's part of our heritage, when you have violated that first commandment, and market uberalis is the defining, forgive my corrupting the word, ethic, that has profound consequences.
It certainly does. I mean, just before the break, Bill said it. I mean, this is the market applied to politics, and that is the thesis of the book in a single sentence. These are the instruments by which market forces were applied to the state. And they, I mean, they sometimes say this very openly and directly. George Bush himself has said, government should be market-based. Government should, think about that. Government should be market-based. What does it mean to put, you know, the public functions at the service of profit? Well, it means we're all seeing what it means. It means that you outsource the departments.
Did I mention it wasn't sustainable?
Well, you're
also describing as the mafia.
Yeah,
that is also a market-based
institution.
Institution.
And by the way, there's a whole chapter in the book. Another way of summarizing the book is we were in the break. We were talking about Lincoln Steffens, sort of a forgotten author nowadays, but he was a great muckraker and he had a theory of corruption. Which is very, I was looking for corruption theories because, you know, it's a study of corruption, among other things. So the way they've wrecked the state, and the corruption is related to the misgovernment. The two things are you know, a yin and yang.
And
Jack Abramoff, George Bush.
And Lincoln Steffens is writing coming out of the Gilded Age and all the robber barons. And there are a lot of folks who've never heard of him. But this is the turn into the 20th century.
That's right.
So here
100 years later.
Ago.
Yeah. Also predominantly the Republican Party.
Right.
That's right, but the Democrats had a hand in it as well back then. But
well, they're not innocent.
No, certainly not. Certainly not.
But stick with this idea.
Okay, but Steffens was very useful to me because he had a theory of corruption, and he put it in the mouth of one of the guys that he interviewed, who was a reformer in St. Louis, and the guy said, "It is good business that causes bad government," and this was the light bulb went on in Steffens' head. And he started studying corruption in all these different cities. And in each case, it was business applied to government. You know, the Chamber of Commerce used to have a slogan. It was their saying. It was, what was it? Less government in business, more business in government.
Which you say has been the conservative.
It's their mantra, yeah.
For always.
Yeah. It sounds benign on the surface. You want government to be able to do, you know, basic bookkeeping.
Oh, people say that to me all the time. We just need to be more business-like in government.
But in one sense, that's perfectly harmless. But what they mean, think about the deeper meaning of that. To like Bush says, government should be market-based. Or like they said in the Clinton era, you needed entrepreneurial government. You need, you know, Well, you know what this means, of course, is it's turning government over to the market. It's getting rid of the civil service, putting them on a for-profit basis. But when government is for profit, then government is up for, it's no longer democracy. It answers to money, not to we the people. It's plutocracy. And this is also what Steffens discovered. And he used to say in his book, his autobiography, he would relate how he. He would sit down with these very corrupt politicians in different cities. He loved to do this. And he would tell them his theory. And he'd say, look, what you're doing seems like good business. You're making a lot of money here in Philadelphia or whatever it is. But think about what you're doing to the country that you love. And these people were all, you know, they loved their country. Everybody does. And he would explain to them that they were making it from a democracy into a plutocracy. And then he would say, in each case, these people would be shocked and they would understand that he was right. And they would be alarmed by this. And the difference between then and now, I mean, there's many, many differences between then and now, but one of them is that doesn't shock these people. That's what they wanted to do. And that's what they have done.
There's also a piece. Steffens did not have to deal directly, the environment he was working in did not have to deal directly with the personhood of corporations. The supposed Supreme Court decision had been rendered by that point. It didn't say that, but that's another
story.
And it didn't happen, but we now have this condition where corporations are treated as people under the Constitution of the United States, which means they have all the rights and privileges that you and I have, except they don't get to die. They're not obligated
which is bad news.
And it's hard to put them in jail. I mean, there are all sorts of strange problems with that. But what you're, you know, the core of this, it's not just the market. It's not just the economics. It is the entities, the individuals who are dominant, the powers in business and the resources that they can bring to bear that is really the focal point of that. That is the real engine that drives this thing you're talking about, because it runs on money.
Yeah, absolutely.
You guys didn't quite finish the part about the reporters, and it is the direct feedback into what Bill's saying. Some of the answer to why it hasn't been reported is because these reporters work for and get their living from big businesses who are making big money off of this very process.
But I should also mention that reporters aren't, they don't do analysis. They don't connect dots.
That's, well, they could.
If they felt like it, but they wouldn't be able to do it in the newspaper, not in the newspaper's time. They wouldn't. Look, I didn't report all of this stuff firsthand. My stuff comes from the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and things like Government Executive Magazine, which you would only read if you live in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
But hey, if you want to write a book like this, you're going to be reading Government Executive Magazine.
You're a hardcore insomniac, I assume.
And hey, there's some good reporters over there. I mean, I made friends with them.
Well, at least
they
collected this stuff for you.
But then it's up to people like me to try to develop a theory out of this. And so that's what I was trying to do. Is what Lincoln Steffens did was develop a theory. Now let me take a step back here. There is the second to last chapter of the book is about the conservatives' corruption theory, because they got their own corruption theory.
We'll and you know give what their you 30 theory is? Can you do it in 12 seconds?
It's not that the state might be corrupted, it's that the state is corruption. How do you like that, Paula?
It takes my breath away. We're going to be back in a moment. I'll think about it. Stay with us. This is Paula Gordon Show, and I am Paula with my breath still taken away by Thomas Frank. Bill Russell is here as well. The state is corruption? What does that mean?
That means the market is this pure free. The market, as I said earlier, is civil society. The market is the natural site of, that's where humans, you know, do their stuff. Whereas government is an imposition. And they've written enormous books of theory on this, that government acts through a form of extortion, that taxation is a form of theft, that whatever government does is essentially a criminal act. And these are the leaders of the conservative movement, by the way, who believe this. And you can find conservative theorists who say, you know, government should not criminalize things like insider trading on Wall Street or price fixing between companies. I even found a conservative theorist that thinks that bribery in certain circumstances, nothing wrong with that. That's business acting in self-defense against the hated, imposing liberal state.
You talk about market, but you're really talking about capitalism.
Yeah. Yeah, business.
And you kind of let capitalism off the hook by talking about market or free market or whatever.
Well,
they're entwined in this context.
The thing is, what I've always said, I've written every book that I've written is about capitalism. You don't understand America if you don't understand capitalism. I mean, that's what this country is about. So when I was in graduate school, that's what I studied. I studied advertising or something like that. But it's always been capitalism. That's the system that we live under. And so that is what I mean. But
we're not talking Marxist theory here either. We're talking about the reality
that
is the American experience.
There's capitalism, and then there was capitalism in the 1960s when I was growing up, and this country had a very equal distribution of wealth. It was a totally different world. The workers by and large were unionized. People had health care. Blue collar people lived next door to white collar people. It was the great. It was the affluent society. And today, still a capitalist country, but a very different one.
Well, the genius of the Constitution was the balance of power between among the three branches, and that balance of power seems to be necessary, extended through the entire community, the entire body politic. If one group, let's call them plutocrats, gets control by whatever means, if money is what matters, and they've got all the money, then you get the kinds of radical distortions that we're now seeing.
Yeah,
and it leaves everybody else out. And again, it seems to me that is not sustainable. It never has in history been sustainable.
It's not sustainable because the what they're interested in, of course, is immediate gain. Look, this is the nature of capitalism. It always prioritizes immediate gain over long term, And so they, you know, they wrecked down the regulatory state because the regulatory state, you know, OSHA bugs them, you know, labor unions bug them. All these things are cutting down on their profit margin. They want them gone. They get them gone. And then look what happens. They cannibalize themselves. I mean, they revert instantly to 19th century form, as we're seeing before our very eyes.
They also externalize cost, and that's the part that nobody wants to talk about. They leave the corporation, they leave the entity, but they go out into the world at large. Clean air is an obvious example. Polluted foods. I mean, the list.
Externalized costs, like you and I bailing out AIG.
Tremendous debt.
As an example.
Yeah.
Did I mention socializing the debt and privatizing
the profit?
We made a. For the first time in my life, we went to the other Hyde Park this summer, not the one in Chicago, which has an honorable tradition of its own. This was Franklin Delano and Eleanor Roosevelt's home. And it was one of those aha moments when I said, oh, yes, we don't have to do it that way. We can do it a different way. And it was very much within the capitalist system, and Franklin Roosevelt was called a traitor to his class because he never left that class. He kept saying, I saved capitalism from themselves. Why are they being mean to me? There is hope in this rather dire story that you tell, that it doesn't have to be that way.
It doesn't have to be that way, but are you ready for the really pessimistic side, Paula?
Yeah. Because I can give you the optimistic side.
The last chapter of the book, I told you about the second to last, the last chapter of the book is about the conservatives' quest for permanence. This is a word they use a lot. Permanence. What they have in mind is not just winning an election here and there, not just beating the Democratic Party or something like that, but permanently removing liberal options from the table. So you couldn't bring back a New Deal state, even if you wanted to. And by the way, this has been done successfully in a number of countries, and they've got all sorts of different strategies for doing this, whether it's through trade deals that you can't alter, or whether it's through privatizing Social Security, which, believe me, would be the A-bomb of this whole battle that we're talking about. Once that's gone, you know, the welfare state is literally off the table. But there's any number of ways that they've used to make their vision of the state permanent. And one of them is the outsourcing and privatizing of all this federal work. How are you going to get that back? You know, and another one is deficits. They build up these monster deficits, and you're stuck with it. You're stuck with it for 20 or 30 years. They've been very successful at dreaming up these schemes. This is where we were talking about the strategy earlier, of dreaming up these schemes, these strategies for making their way permanent and shutting our side down, my side down for good. And our team has nobody thinking along those lines.
Permanence only works if you don't believe in evolution.
There you go.
If you catch my drift.
Very good. Hadn't thought of that.
Well, think about it.
Intelligent design. Now, this is intelligent design. It's intelligent misdesign.
My point, exactly.
Exactly.
It's also short-termist in remarkable ways, again, as we're seeing in the markets, even as we speak.
Yeah.
This, again, is not sustainable.
And the only constant is change. That, I told you I could find a way out of your pessimism. There it is.
All right, Paula.
We are delighted to have had you with us, Thomas Frank. We hope that you will continue to write these important books and to bring those pieces together for us.
Next book is going to be a collection of my sonnets.
Oh, I thought maybe the next book was about baseball. Thanks for being
That's
with
close.
Us.
In The Wrecking Crew, Thomas Frank carefully documents decades of Republicans undermining democracy at home and abroad, along with their plans to make these changes permanent. He has our admiration and our thanks for bringing painful and hugely important facts out into the open. We all have to know what we're up against before we can join together to resurrect our democracy. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.